put 50,000 candy money in this pot, right?
It was 300 Quaker, probably in the pot.
They steal the store, they turn it to candy.
Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Just trying to lie.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell can they do? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. I'm back here and not in the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show. We're in the apartment of our friend Martin J. McNally. I call him Mac, and his friends call him Mac, with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
From the mouths of the guy and the mouth of the guy that did it, the great skyjacking of 1972, which was one of a series of skyjackings during that 1971-72, where they used the 727 to lower the rear stairs and walk down the stairs and bail out with the money. Everybody was caught but D.B. Cooper, and I still keep accusing my friend Mac here of being D.B. Cooper. He keeps denying it now. Mac, are you
probably
sure you're not D.B. Cooper?
Do.
I don't know.
I'm not.
He looks like
they,
him.
They thought
he?
I was,
did
but
you
I'm
ever,
not.
Did you ever spend any time in Washington State?
He did. He did, 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, I know the area.
Did they,
see?
Did you have any appearance of, did you look a lot in your, when you were younger, like D.B. Cooper?
I don't know. I can't say.
Did they think you did?
I don't know. They thought I did.
Oh, I bet they did. I bet they bore down on that one because they just wanted to solve that one big day. They would have had a promotion and been a hero if they'd have solved.
Have you ever been camping along the Columbia River?
Yeah, I have.
Uh-oh. See, I think we're getting down to it.
Vancouver, Washington.
Statute of limitations up on that.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's carry on. They're here.
Still looking for the money.
Yeah, they are.
They found a little bit
they
of
found $5,800 of it.
Yeah, which isn't very much, but I'm surprised they found that.
More left. Of course, not near as much as that farmer up in Peru, Indiana found, was it? We'll get to that part of the story in a minute.
We'll talk about this.
We are up and down and around in the airport. Aaron gave you a nice synopsis at the end of the last segment. We won't go back into that. We have been hit by, what's his name? Mike Handley.
David Handley,
David,
who was 30 at the time, was a St. Louis businessman. He'd been sitting at a motel bar near the airport when he became aware of the unfolding hijack out on the runway, and he decided to act upon that. He told a friend, "Turn on the radio in a few minutes, and you'll hear something that will change your world."
Shake the world.
Shake the world.
Shake the world. Interesting.
And he left. A few minutes later, Handley began his chase of the taxiing jet at speeds of 90 miles an hour. The plane was actually taxiing.
That's what he said. That's what Max just told us in the last episode. It was taxiing, and he ran into you.
Mac,
well,
you were in the plane. As you had said in the last episode, you pulled the shades down so that they couldn't see inside or see where you were at in the plane.
Yes, that's
so your
right.
ability to kind of tell what's going on around you is really based upon what the pilot's telling you.
Yes, that's true.
Which is a good thing he said something instead of...
Yeah. He said, "We can't take off. We've been hit."
You felt the hit.
Yes.
Actually, twice. It jarred the plane.
Yes, it jarred the plane twice, and I thought there was a faking me, trying to get me.
How did they convince you that it wasn't just a ploy?
The stewardess told me that we've been hit by a car, and we're going to have to do something.
So you believed her? You convinced by her demeanor and everything.
That's when I told her. I said, "Well, if this is real and this plane catches fire, we got to jump out this emergency door with the money and me and you and my gun, and we'll get away from the plane. But we're going to have to figure out how to get another plane here." And that's what happened. But
now, at this point, I think just a real recap is that you the crew that you took off with in Flight 119, which was the original flight at 2:35, American Airlines Flight 2119 that left St. Louis, went towards Tulsa, came back. They actually changed the crew out, so you had a second crew.
We had a second crew. The original crew was willing to go along, but since they raised the issue, I said, let's get a fresh crew in here because I don't want any mistakes to happen. So there was a delay, and we got the other crew. If I had just gone along with the pilot and the crew with the original crew, we'd have been in the air before Hanley got into his Cadillac and slammed into us. He was in the Marriott Inn across from the airport, drinking in the bar. He'd gotten there about 5 p.m.
So he was drunk, wasn't he?
He was totally drunk.
And this was like midnight.
He was totally drunk from 5 p.m. to midnight. A couple minutes after midnight, he got up. He was watching the television and in the bar there, and he told the people, "You keep watching that program there," and this was minute-by-minute coverage.
Yeah.
The stations in St. Louis dropped all their coverage, and they had...
live coverage of the actual event taking place.
Yeah, they had live coverage on all the stations on what was going down at the airport. They had thousands and thousands of people at the airport, and everything on I-70 was backed up for a couple of miles because people wanted to get in the airport to see what the hell was going on. You know, all that stuff that was going out there, I didn't know. I didn't find out about it until later.
Well, you had said in the last segment or the last episode we talked about this, when they did change the crew, you were suspicious that one of them wasn't a crew member.
Yes, that's true.
And they weren't. And then early in that, in the segment or episode before that, you talked about getting the parachute and then bringing somebody on who's supposedly a expert of parachutes, and you didn't believe that guy was an expert either, FBI agent.
That's true. I mean,
you must have been really paranoid at this point.
I was very paranoid that these people were going to do these FBI agents coming on board and trying to blow me away, and my inclination was correct. That they had brought a flight engineer, Posen. He was an FBI agent, and he had a pistol, and his primary purpose on this thing was to blow me away first chance that he got.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't take that initiative, and so I survived.
They're taxiing out there. This guy David Handley hits the plane. It's disabled. There you are, sitting on the runway. You've got the money. You've got the shovel. You've got the gloves, but you have no way to get out.
If this pilot had not terminated the takeoff, because he was rolling, and he put on the brakes because he snapped that there was a vehicle on the runway. But if he had not snapped, and if we were going, let's say, 70 or 80 miles an hour down that runway and got hit by that Cadillac, coming at us, that nose gear would have collapsed, running down the runway, sparks and everything. We'd have probably blown up at that point there. The pilot putting on the brakes, stopping, that's what saved us from the major explosion. But at that point, it was very precarious.
Because you had the plane refueled as well.
It was fully topped off. Tanks were fully topped off. Ready to go, yes.
So, but now you're stopped dead on the tarmac.
We're stopped dead on the tarmac.
This guy's got his car. It's underneath the plane you're in.
And I got to order another plane.
And then these guys come up. All of a sudden, the fire trucks come onto the tarmac, and they're throwing, you know, flame retardant foam on it. Now, your paranoia must have just been, because at this point, they're so close to the plane.
It's dangerous, yes. I was definitely paranoid.
Did you go up and look out to see what was going on outside finally?
No, I never did.
You never did, boy.
I never did. I told him we got to get another plane, and the pilot said, where do you want to put it?
So they reassured you pretty quick they were going to get another plane.
Oh, yeah, they reassured me fast. I told them to take any 727 on this tarmac here, runway, and bring it out here, and the pilot said, where do you want to put it? I said, put it about 200 feet in front of us and have the rear steps down. And what we're going to do is we're going to board that plane. We're going to take the pilot and co-pilot and flight engineer are going to go over there first, And then with the hostage, so there's four people are going to go over there first. And then the stewardess and myself are going to board. That's what happened. We went down the stewardess. I went down the stairs. I had my attaché case up, covering my face, because I knew they had snipers trying to take me
out. I was going
to
say, that would have been a vulnerable point for you.
Very vulnerable, very dangerous. And I made sure that to tell the FBI on the ground that if they any lights go off, any flashlights go off, I mean cameras go off or anything, this thing could end very fast with major explosions. So we walked down the stairs. It was then that I noticed this vehicle under the main strut on the left.
So you knew they weren't lying then, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, yeah. You knew there was something there, but you didn't know. That guy could have been an FBI agent as well.
He could have been. I had no idea.
Was he still in his vehicle?
No, they had taken him out of the vehicle.
Oh, okay.
They had taken him out, taken him to the hospital.
He'd been injured.
He was pretty much screwed up. Yeah, he was injured.
Now, I want to say that I had read that when you changed planes, you were surrounded by hostages.
No, I wasn't surrounded by anybody. I only had one stewardess with me. One stewardess with me and my attaché case, that was it.
Which is really, really exposed.
Yeah, but I guess the threat that you would set off the grenade was probably...
I was really exposed. If I'd have given these... they had five snipers, four or five snipers on me. And if they could have gotten a headshot, I'm sure they would have taken it. But I had the attaché case over my head with my right arm and the gun in my left hand. And when we got halfway between these two planes, I turned around and I looked at the plane. I noticed somebody in a truck with the light on in the truck. He was looking at me, and I thought I saw a rifle in his hand. And I took my gun and pointed at him. I think I started to pull that trigger. If it had been a hair trigger on it, weapon, I think it would have fired off.
This was the 25 caliber handgun.
No, this was the 45 caliber rifle. It looked like a grease gun. It didn't have a hair trigger, but if it had, I think it would have fired off at that point. But as I'm holding it, looking at him for a couple of seconds there, it wasn't very long, he raised his arm, put him in the air, and as soon as I saw his arms go up in the air, I pulled back the gun, and I told the stewardess, I said, okay, let's go. So the stewardess and I walked about another 50 to 100 feet, and we boarded the steps, and I told, I think I had the stewardess there, and the co-pilot, I'm not sure, but I told them, let's get these stairs raised and get this plane in the air in a matter of a minute. And so they raised the stairs, and within a couple of minutes at most, we were rolling down the runway, and we were in the air.
So when you got on this other plane, it's a different flight number, and it's kind of an interesting fact that when you read some of the material that's out there, you're actually charged with hijacking two planes.
I got
because of this.
I got two life sentences in this case.
Because this other guy, David Hanley, disabled the plane that you really did hijack.
Yes, that's true.
That didn't seem fair.
It's not fair.
did he ever serve any time for anything? Did they?
He was indicted by the U.S. attorney for interfering with a flight. But the fact is, he was in the hospital, critically injured. And on the very day that my case went before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, he announced that he was dismissing the charges against this guy because it really wasn't in the interest of the federal government to charge a John Q. Public who tried to be a hero and stop a criminal activity. So the charges were dropped, and so you're getting double publicity on this thing. My case is going before the Court of Appeals, and this guy's being
let go.
Dismissed, let go.
But his actions, I mean, you could have pulled the trigger and other people could have died as a result of him doing this.
That could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't, and it's fortunate that that's not the case, but...
Or he could have caught the plane on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything could have blown up. The FBI was concerned that with this happening...
They didn't want other people to come out and stop hijackings, I would think.
Yes, that's true. But they had figured that if I really had had a bomb, I would have blown it up at that particular point. I wasn't going to end this event by going stark raving mad. I mean, I was doing this rationally and until I'm definitely under attack.
Because no one had taken any shots at you.
No, no shots.
Right. I mean, they cooperated.
Surprising, you know, in that 200 feet between the plane, because it's such an exposed walk on a tarmac. There's nothing really covering you but a stewardess and a attaché case.
That's it. They had an opportunity to take a shot, let's say, at my belly or my legs. If they wanted to do the legs and the belly, they could have done that. But they weren't stupid. They want a lethal kill.
Yeah.
They wanted the
They didn't
shot.
Want to injure you because then
yes.
you could still make the plane. You may kill other people.
Yes.
But when you were getting on the second plane, I mean, you were having the experience of the guy with the harness that didn't know what he was doing, who was an agent, where you get the feeling that somebody in the exchange crew has a weapon. You weren't nervous about getting on this other plane, like maybe there's somebody hiding?
I told the pilot, I said, when I board this plane, I'm going to check all the seat areas, the aisles,
the bathrooms.
Between the seats.
Not many and places to hide on an airplane.
No place to hide. If I see anybody hiding in the restroom, the restrooms in the plane or in the seats and everything, I'm going to blow them away immediately.
You told them that.
I told them that. And
they believed you.
And they believed me, and nobody was hiding. But, yeah, I would definitely taken them out if there had been.
So you got off the ground pretty quick.
We got off the ground pretty quick. The pilot wanted to know where to go, and I think Coaster was his name. But he came back, and he said, what to now? And I said, well, take it up to 10,000 feet, and let's go along at 500 miles an hour, and we'll lower the steps right now. And he said, you can't get out at 500 miles an hour. And I said, are you sure? He said, the airflow on this plane will hold those steps up. And so it's going to have to be slower. I said, okay, what we need to do is get on the phone here. He did. And tell the pilot to slow down, speed up, slow down, speed up, until we get the steps where I want them. So that's what he did. And the pilot sped up, slowed down. Until I had about a 2-foot area between the steps and the fuselage.
Where there was enough space you could actually exit the plane.
Get down on this and...
But you were really looking through the window that was the door, right, on the back of the plane to see that.
No, the stairs are down and there's no window.
You're just looking down the stairs and you can see a gap between
I'm looking down the stairs. As a matter of fact, the co-pilot said, when I open this door... I don't know what's going to happen. We could be pulled out here. I don't know. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull the lever, and then I'm going to jump up forward. So don't get shook about this.
Because the plane's going to depressurize.
Well, no, it was not pressurized.
Oh, okay.
You were low enough. You were 10,000
yeah,
feet.
Yeah, so. The plane was not pressurized at that point. But he pulled the lever. He jumped forward. And I was out of the way probably 15 feet up. Then once the stairs were down, then he got on the phone to talk to the pilot, and it was speed up, down, slow, until we got it 2 feet where I could get out of that thing. And then he went up to the cockpit, and I said, proceed on to Toronto, Canada, and take it down to 300 feet on the runway so I can verify where we're at. Now, he went up to the cockpit. I was in the back. And at that point there, I was sitting down. The stairs are open. I'm sitting down. And I start to figure out what I'm going to do next. And I take the gun, and I take the clip off. And I had the Allen wrenches to dismantle this gun and piece it out at the back. But there wasn't enough time. This was late. I mean, we're talking about 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning. I threw out the gun. I took off the harness and laid that aside. I took off my pants. I took off my suit.
This was that yellow pants and was that matching suit coat?
I took off the suit coat and I took off my shirt and I threw them out the back. And I threw out the wig. I threw out the wig. Now, there's something else here. When they gave me that money, that $2,200 or $2,400, that was bogus money. And I was pissed off about it. And I gave, there were a lot of $1 bills here. But I had two stacks of tens, $1,000 each, plus ones. And I said, what's this? This is monkey money. I didn't order this. And he says, oh, I don't know. So I gave the stewardess. I says, come here. There were four stewardesses there. And I said, I'm going to give you girls some money here. But the only reason I'm going to give this to you is if you keep this money and you don't turn it into the airlines. And I said, if you promise me that, I'll give you the money. And all the girls said, we promise.
They lied.
So I gave them the money, and I kept a roll.
All the tens.
I banded $10 bills, and there were 100 of those. But as I'm getting ready to bail out, get ready to do the number, this money was still bulky. So yeah, I broke the band, and I threw out what turned out to be $700. So when I hit the ground, I had approximately 30 $10 bills. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
And now, how did you attach the big leather satchel to yourself? You attached that to your harness?
No, I attached that to a belt. And what I had was a leather belt with a leather buckle. And I attached the handle to the handle of the mailbag.
About how heavy was it? Do you remember?
About 40 pounds.
Okay.
40, 45 pounds. And I also had some damn twine. I should have had rope. But the fact is I had some thin twine. That was stupid. And so I wrapped some of that around my leg. So we're up in the plane, and we're heading on to Toronto. We're at 10,000 feet, and we're finally going at 300 miles an hour. After a certain amount of time, I said, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. I had maps. I had everything to determine where I really wanted to go. But the time constraints were there. And wherever I had to go, it had to be now. We're in about 2:30, quarter to 3 during the summer. It gets light early, and I can't have it getting light because coming out of the plane in a city or farmland. So what I did was I went up to the cockpit and I told the pilot. I says, I need to see the altimeter. I need to see the what else? Altimeter.
The speedometer.
Airspeed.
Airspeed.
I need to see the magnetic compass. I need to see the direction. I forget what else, but there were four instruments that I looked at. And I said, okay, continue on to Toronto and make the beeline on the down the runway and so forth, and then level out at 5,000 feet and take it on to JFK. And I closed the door to the cockpit. And I went to the back. There was a curtain. There was a curtain there. The curtain, they couldn't see me in the back with that curtain up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the back. I threw out everything at that point.
How did they know when you jumped out?
Yeah, if the stairs were lowered so there had been some indicator light, that wouldn't tell them anything. If the cabin was already depressurized, then how would they?
Here's how we knew. The pilot was flying on manual drive.
Mm-hmm.
So he had his hands on the control stick, the steering wheel for the plane. When I was on the stairs, when I released myself, that 200 pounds of weight on that plane caused the configuration of the plane to rise up.
Oh, so he felt that.
So he felt it in his stick. So he knew that I pretty much that I, something had happened.
Now, in one article I read, the pilot claimed that when he thought you were out there on those stairs, he made the plane jump around in order to try to slide you off.
No, he didn't do that at all.
Okay. He didn't jog the plane to try to...
There was no jumping to that plane. He didn't do a damn thing. We were riding along as steady as can be. So when I went out of this thing, what he was supposed to do was turn on the lights, the exterior lights, to let the FBI trail plane. They had a trail plane.
Oh, I see. That's how they knew.
They had a trail plane about a mile behind us that was above us that I couldn't see, because I told them I don't want any trail planes. But yeah,
and they said no, there won't be any.
There won't be any.
There won't. Trust me.
I'm with the FBI. I'm ready to help you.
Yeah, they had a trail plane, and I'll tell you about that here. When I was gingerly and cautiously going down these stairs, and it was precarious, I'm telling you, scary. I got to the bottom of the stairs, and I was sitting there, and I was using both my feet to see how this air was going over the stairs, and it was kind of cool because I know we're doing 300 miles an hour. So I had to figure out, how am I going to just bail out of this thing? And what I did was I eased out my body, and I turned over so that I'm facing down, I'm facing the earth, and I had two hands, both hands, on the bottom step. I looked up. I'm getting ready to release myself. I looked up, and I said, boy, this is tough. If there was somebody from the cockpit coming down here to see me, they could shoot me right now. I'd be dead on my way. I looked around, made sure I was clear, and released myself. When I released myself, I immediately rolled over onto my back, and I started flying straight down, feet first, and I was doing 300 miles an hour. Now, I know that I'm braking all the way down. I'm going from 300 miles an hour, and my speed is slowing all the way down until I reach terminal velocity, which is about 130 miles an hour. I know I got to go about 1 mile, because we're up 2 miles in the air. I got to go about 1 mile free fall. So as I'm free falling, somehow I wound up where I was facing Earth. And I was flying down with both my hands out and my feet out. And I looked at my hands, and the air was, you couldn't see the air, but you could feel that air going over my hands. And I looked around, looked at the sky, and I said to myself, this is cool. This is really, really cool. I got down where I figured I was down enough, about a mile.
How would you figure that? I mean, you're free falling in pitch black. You know you're at about 10,000 feet. You did the math in your head beforehand to go, I've got to count 60 seconds, 70 seconds, and then...
I didn't do any counting, but I figured that about probably 20 to 25 seconds would be enough. And I calculated that in my head. So as I'm flying down, I'm gonna get ready to pull the ripcord. I took my right hand in, and I left my left hand out. And because I had done that, I went into a spin, and I panicked. I started to spin, and I immediately went to the ripcord, and I pulled the ripcord. And when the ripcord came open, I was facing the earth, and it was a spring-loaded parachute. It popped out, and it popped out about 2 feet. My eyes are wide open, and it came back and hit me in the head. It hit me in the jaw. It blacked my eyes. My chin was screwed up. I immediately took my both hands up to the shroud lines on the parachute, and I pulled on them. And I knew that if I had resistance, I was okay. If I didn't have resistance, the panels were blown out on that thing, and I'd probably be dead. So it'd be time to say a good act of contrition.
Yeah.
I'm a good Catholic boy.
Yes.
So I got resistance on that, and then I took my left hand and came down to my leg to slap my leg and to make sure I got the mailbag. And I'll be damned. I looked down, and the mailbag was rolling in the air probably 50 feet from me. With that, I said, damn. So with the bombing experience I have in the service, I know that and the finding directions, you need to have vector points on the ground. If I can get 3 vector points on the ground, I'll probably be able to locate that parcel on the ground.
Well, the bag didn't have a parachute.
It no.
It separated from you the moment you pulled the ripcord.
Yeah.
The bag is continuing to plummet at 100 and some miles an hour. And
yeah, let me tell you about that belt. It was a leather belt with a leather buckle. When I got home, I had an identical belt, and I looked at that thing, and it had 2 snaps on the buckle.
Yeah, so that's it.
Yeah, I said, that's it.
That was the deal.
I said, my God, 2 snaps, both snaps, because when that parachute opened up, it was huge, because we're doing maybe 140 miles an hour, and you're coming to a dead stop. Boom, anything hanging on your body, if it isn't properly secured, it's going to go flying. And that's what happened. And so that's what happened there. The money's gone, and I'm looking at it. I'm looking for a vector point. I'm looking for points on the ground, lights and whatever else. And I can see nothing. And I see the bag go into clouds. And at that point there, I'm about a mile up in the air. I start screaming, raising my hands and going, motherfucker, God damn it, Jesus Christ. I can't believe this shit. All this work for nothing. And oh, God.
Everything you'd been through to get to that point.
I said, it's over. I'm finished with it. So I disconnected my right leg strap. I disconnected my left leg strap. And I went up to my chest and I disconnected the chest strap. And I was ready to just release myself and go down and hit the ground suicide. Instant death when you hit the ground. But then I said, well, wait a minute here. Both hands are on his chest strap, the clip. And I connected it back up. And I said, well, wait a minute here. The money's gone, but I'm still here. The money can be replaced, but I can't. And I'm about one in 50 million. People, very few people have pulled a score like this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm going to do this again. I'll be up in the air within 2 weeks.
That's a good one.
three weeks at most. I said, I'm up in the air thinking about this.
Hey, I mean, you're just drifting down.
I'm
now.
Drifting down, and I'm thinking about the next plane I'm going to take.
What else could a guy think about while he's drifting down?
Where's that money, and how can I get these vector points?
Yeah.
Because the money would go pretty straight, but the chute's going to make you drift.
The money's gone. When I can't get those vector points, it's over on the money. No, it's over, and I'll explain why in a second. But I'm coming down thinking about the next score. I have another one within 2 or 3 weeks. And I says, I'm going to get a plane at Indianapolis. I'm going to get a plane at Indianapolis, and I'm going to get $1 million next time in 2 parcels, and I'm going to throw out $500,000 and let them know that it's me again. The St. Louis Skyjacker's back. I lost some money before, but I'm not going to lose it this time.
You got a admired guy that thinks big.
Yeah. I'm going to get it again and so forth and so on, but I hit the ground. I'm coming down. I hit the ground.
Still pitch black out.
It's pitch black out.
You mentioned something to me that you didn't know if you were over Lake Michigan or not, because you'd been headed straight north from St. Louis.
Yes.
North, and that could have been up over one of the Great Lakes. You didn't know.
Let me tell you what happened on that. That as I'm hanging on the steps with my feet out, it was clear. There weren't any clouds. And then after a couple of minutes, it was white. And I couldn't discern if that was water. And I said, damn, I must be over Lake Michigan now. And I figured that I was coming out over Lake Michigan. I'm a good swimmer.
Weighted down with $500,000.
Yeah.
You have to be a good swimmer.
You are not a guy to be deterred. I can see that. You are one stubborn dude.
I'm a good swimmer, so I was going to go out anyway. And, so I hit the ground, and I'm telling you, I hit the ground hard. The parachute hit first, and then my back hit, and then my head hit. That was my first parachute jump, by the way. I mean, I'd never...
You've never been in a parachute?
I'd never put on a parachute. And even though I was in aviation and aboard patrol planes and stuff, we had parachutes on the plane, but I never put on a harness or clipped a parachute on. All I had at this time here was a reserve chute. So I hit the ground, hit hard on my head, and then I jumped up, and I needed to collapse the parachute. So I start running at it, but I'm running at it the wrong, pulling in the shroud lines. So I went to the top shroud lines and pulled them in, got the chute collapsed, and then I just stood there. I stood there for a couple of minutes. I hear all these damn dogs for miles. The dogs are barking. Ruff, 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 ruff. They knew something was up. The dogs did. So I didn't see any lights going on in any of the houses. I pulled the chute in.
So this was out over farmland, though, wasn't it? But you could see farmhouses around.
This was a farmland. I was fortunate that I landed where I did. I landed right in, not the middle, but on the side of a farm. And it was an unplanted farm. But before I landed, I threw out my shovel. I was about 1,000 feet, I think, when I threw out the shovel, because I knew I wouldn't need it to bury the mail bag.
Yeah.
I just threw it out. So I landed, and I got the chute collapsed, gathered up. I noticed trees 20 feet away from me, and I got to get to the trees because I can't go anywhere. My head's spinning. I'm seeing stars. I originally wanted to hot wire a car and get out of the area, but I couldn't because I was hurt when I landed, my head. So I went to the edge of the trees, and I noticed a barbed wire fence. I said, damn, I'm lucky I didn't hit that. So I climbed over that fence, and then there was another barbed wire fence. And I said, damn, two fences. If I'd hit these if I'd hit these fences, I would have tore me a new asshole. And I said, I was lucky on that. So I took my chute and went into the trees about 5 or 10 feet, totally pitch black. And I couldn't go in any further. I laid the chute down and laid on top of it and probably took a nap. About 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, it was starting to get light. I got up. I was cold. So I took the chute and moved into the trees about 20 to 25 feet. And I laid the chute down under a tree, put some leaves over it, climbed into the chute, and went to sleep again. The next thing I know, I hear a helicopter. So I'm looking. I'm hearing this chopper. I know they're looking for me. The shadow of the rotors on the chopper went right over me. So this guy's less than 200 feet away from me, flying right over me. And I didn't move. Stayed under the parachute. When they went away, I went back to sleep. And I think it was about 5 o'clock, 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. And I got up. I brushed off my clothes. I had, I forget what I had on. I had a blue Bandolon shirt and nice spit shine shoes. And I didn't have on jeans, but so I'm ready to go without a coat and just my Bandolon shirt. So,
but you actually don't even really quite know where you're at this point.
I don't know what state I'm in. I have no idea. I could have been in California. I climbed over these barbed wire fences and went out to the road. And I stood on the road and I saw a car go by. And this was a secondary road. It wasn't a main road. I saw a car go by. It had an Indiana plate.
So you knew you were in Indiana?
No. I had to see more plates.
Okay.
So another car rolled by, and I saw another Indiana plate. I saw four Indiana plates. I said, "You are in Indiana somewhere."
Did they
where?
See?
You don't know.
Did they see you at all?
They didn't pay any attention to me.
Yeah, you were just a guy.
You're just a guy walking on the road.
Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up, because from here on out, it gets real interesting where we have a sheriff that picks you up. You go to a hotel and you make your way back to Detroit. And that will be our final session for the actual skyjacking attempt. Then we'll go on to the
next
one.
We can do that. Yes, we can do that.
All right.
Yes.
Because this story continues.
It continues, folks. And
a long way.
All right. So, if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol yourself, or you have a friend or relative that has problems with addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or if you're from out of town, go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. I think that's all I got, Aaron.
Oh, and you also remember, you want to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app, where you can get it on your smartphone, Apple or Android.
Get it on your Android from the Blueberry side.
Yeah, get it on your Android.
From the Appy Pie side.
From Appy Pie. And take your own personal tour of notorious mob locations in Kansas City while you listen to one of our podcasts about Nick Savella or Tuffy DeLuna or
Joe Augusto
or Carl
Joey
Sparrow.
Iupa. Well, if you want to go to Carl Sparrow, or if you want to go to Chicago, you can drive around Chicago and Cicero and learn about Chicago mob, and go to the 2-part episode we have on Joey Iupa. And then we have Chicago and Nick Savella in the Chicago outfit connection. So we have all kinds of mafia stuff.
And you can hang out at Union Station there in Kansas City and listen to an episode about the Union Station massacre.
And see the bullet holes in Union Station,
which are on the app as well.
Right. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.